created momentum because you've created urgency around a previously unknown or perhaps undervalued opportunity or problem. Now it's time to press. Sounds straightforward enough, right? As any sales leader knows, these things like comfort discussing money and pressuring the customer are easier said than done for the average sales rep. That's why challengers can be so hard to find. As human beings, our natural inclination is to seek closure, not postpone it, to reduce tension, not increase it. For sales reps, this translates into a tendency to agree with the customer, not present a different and potentially unsettling point of view. Yet challenger reps have learned to do just that. Given our natural propensities as people, how in the world do you increase the willingness and ability of your sales reps, especially those reps most predisposed to wanting to reduce tension, your relationship builders, to take control? In this chapter, we're going to talk about some very practical approaches to helping reps understand the best ways to take control. But first, let's explore this notion of taking control in a bit more depth. Three misconceptions about taking control. We spent a fair bit of time earlier dispelling false notions around some of the concepts in the challenger selling model, but nowhere is there more confusion around the idea of taking control. We generally encounter three main misconceptions. First, taking control is synonymous with negotiation. Second, reps only take control regarding matters of money. Third, reps will become too aggressive if we tell them to take control. Let's take these one at a time. First, the common perception, given that the data suggests that challengers are comfortable discussing money, is that taking control is synonymous with negotiation, in that it is typically done at the end of the sales process. This couldn't be further from the truth. Misconception number one, taking control is synonymous with negotiation. One of the biggest misconceptions about taking control is that it's about negotiation skills. But SEC research shows that challengers take control across the entirety of the sales process, not just at the end. In fact, one of the prime opportunities for taking control is actually right at the beginning of the sale. Challengers know that many sales opportunities that appear viable on the surface are little more than veiled verification efforts by a customer. In other words, they're cases in which the customer has already chosen a vendor to partner with, but feels the need to do some due diligence to make sure they're getting the best deal they can, so they entertain conversations with other vendors, even though they have little intention of changing their minds. In cases like this, which our research shows can be nearly 20% of all sales opportunities, the customer will assign a more junior member of the organization to field an RFP and meet with all of the potential vendors. But again, because the customer has no intention of actually buying from any of these suppliers, they only allow reps to meet with the junior contact, never permitting access to more senior decision makers. For most reps, this isn't seen as a problem. In fact, most reps love these opportunities. What's not to love? After all, the customer called us. The typical rep response is to continue to spend time with the junior contact in the hopes of turning that individual into an advocate, eventually clawing one's way into the corner office. What we often hear from reps is something along the lines of, "We know money is going to be spent if there's an RFP out there, so it's stupid for us not to put ourselves into consideration. We at least have a chance." But even in this early stage of the sale, challengers know better. They sniff out these foils immediately and press the contact for expanded access in exchange for continued dialogue. When these contacts don't grant the access challenger reps know will be critical to completing the sale, their response is to cut the sales effort short and move on to the next opportunity. It seems so counterintuitive to the average rep. After all, you've got a customer that's put out an RFP for a solution you can provide, so you know there's funding for the purchase. They've also agreed to meet with the rep, and customer FaceTime is so hard to get these days. Why would you ever want to walk away from a situation like this? But that's exactly what a challenger does. Challenger reps know their time is better spent elsewhere. One SEC member, a global business services provider, has institutionalized this challenger behavior across its entire sales force. This company teaches its reps to push for expanded access right from the get-go. Since much of their business is done through RFPs, they're almost always starting their sales conversations with lower-level functionaries within the customer organization, often in procurement. They tell their reps that an early litmus test of how serious a given customer is about partnering is whether they will agree to grant the supplier sales rep access to key stakeholders. This has proven to be a remarkably accurate tell for a customer's real intentions, and it's helped the company's reps to avoid wasting time. Their reps are taught, at the close of the first interaction, to say, "You know, typically when we engage with a customer for this sort of solution, we need certain key executives to be involved in the purchase decision. Is that the case here?" When the customer says yes, the rep asks if she'll be able to meet with those individuals. If the contact hems and haws or gives an unclear answer, the rep pushes and explains that if they can't guarantee time with those key leaders, she'll be unable to check that everybody is aligned on the value of the solution, and therefore, it doesn't make sense to continue engaging in further discussions. Neil Rackham shared with us a similar story from his research. A big problem, he explained to us, is the customer who invites a salesperson to come in, analyze a problem, and generate creative solutions. Many sales organizations will spend well into the six figures to pursue a complex opportunity. All too often, though, the customer encourages this free consulting work until the best solution becomes clear, at which point they go shopping for the cheapest supplier. This is a core difference between relationship builders and challengers in Rackham's assessment. In my own research, he explains, I saw some reps losing more customers to cheaper suppliers late in the sale because they failed to take control early on. They steered clear of having a tough conversation about the commercial side of the interaction, fearing it would damage the relationship. Other reps, however, confronted the customer early in the sale, saying, you know, it's going to cost us $200K to put our best thinking into your problem. We're willing to do it, but we need some assurance that if we invest in you, you'll invest in us. These reps had far fewer customers switch to cheaper suppliers late in the sales process. This kind of tactic seems to be a hallmark of sales high performers. A recent SEC study revealed that while all reps start their sales efforts by mapping out key stakeholders within the customer organization, core performers then move on to what seems like the next logical step, understanding needs and mapping solutions against those needs. But high performers do something very different. They extend this part of the sales process by digging into these individual stakeholders' varying goals and biases, as well as their business and personal objectives. As we discussed in the tailoring chapter, they map out not just who the key stakeholders are, but what these stakeholders care about and why they care about these things. By doing this, the challenger is in a much better position to be able to take control right from the beginning. Challengers find many opportunities to take control during the sale, again, well in advance of arriving at the negotiating table. Even if a rep can successfully verify a customer's real intentions at the beginning of the sales process, many deals will still get bogged down nevertheless. Challengers distinguish themselves by building momentum within the customer organization, momentum that enables them to drive to a conclusion faster than the typical rep. In our interactions with challenger reps, it's clear that they have a better-than-average appreciation for how hard it is to buy from their companies in general. This complexity in the buying process has less to do with the bureaucratic hurdles that suppliers put in the way of customers, though that surely is an issue in many companies, but with the fact that customers often don't know how to buy themselves. Of course, customers don't lack the basic know-how of buying a complex solution from a provider, but standard purchasing processes and protocols break down when every single solution out there is unique, touching different parts of the organization. Average reps see this complexity too, but their tendency, especially for relationship builders, is to learn and react. They let the customer, who again is likely to be confused by the complexity of purchasing the solution, take the lead. Better to defer to the customer than to rock the boat. The rep asks questions about whom to get involved and what steps to take, but the customer is as lost as the rep. Challengers, by contrast, lead and simplify. Rather than assuming that the customer knows how to execute the purchase of a complex solution, which can be a faulty assumption when it comes to solution selling, they teach the customer how to buy the solution. They extrapolate from past successful sales efforts and apply what they've learned to help the customer work through their purchase process. Instead of asking who needs to be involved, challenger reps coach the customer on who should be involved. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? The commercial teaching approach, as you'll recall, is about getting away from the what's keeping you up at night question and instead bringing unique insight to the customer about what should be keeping them up at night. It's the same idea here. None of this is to suggest that taking control doesn't happen at the end of the sale when both parties are sitting across from each other at the negotiating table. Of course it happens there. We know from the data that challengers shine in negotiation settings. In fact, we'll study this very thing in more depth when we look at a negotiation training best practice from DuPont later in this chapter. That being said, it's a mistake to equate taking control with negotiating. It's far more accurate to think of the latter as a small, albeit important, subset of the former. What's more, a challenger knows that the average sales rep will seek to take control only at the end of the sale, at the negotiating table, and so challengers differentiate themselves by taking control from the very start. Customers value this because they see the challenger as a confident partner in the sales process, not a nervous rep crossing their fingers in the hope of making a sale. Misconception number two, reps take control regarding only matters of money. The data tells us that challengers are able to push the customer. Sure, they can push the customer on financial terms and aspects of the selling and buying process, but more important, they push the customer in terms of how they think about their world and their challenges, as well as the solution to those challenges. This is the essence of commercial teaching, which we discussed earlier in the book, the ability to reframe the way the customer thinks about their world. Why is it important to take control around ideas? Because it's extremely unlikely that a customer, especially a seasoned executive, is going to roll over and accept the reframe that the challenger delivers without a healthy dose of skepticism. More likely, he'll push back. He'll ask why. He'll ask to see the supporting data. He'll say his company is different. These are the questions that make relationship builders' knees go weak. Seeking to diffuse tension, the relationship builder will acquiesce, caving on the argument and hoping to salvage what's left of the conversation, in the end relegating himself to a price-driven conversation about products rather than the bigger, more valuable solution that could have been. But it's this kind of dialogue that the challenger lives for. The challenger will use constructive tension to her advantage. Instead of giving in at the first sign of resistance to her argument, the challenger pushes back. "You're right," she says. "Your company surely is different. But so are the other organizations we work with. And I can tell you that this insight has helped them to rethink the way they run their operations. With your permission, let's explore this idea in more depth and then circle back to make sure I've adequately addressed any concerns you might have." Commercial teaching puts the challenger in a position to take control by bringing new ideas to the table, ideas that the customer hadn't thought of before. But customers are savvy, and conventional wisdom didn't get to be conventional by being easy to topple. There will be pushback, even if the challenger is armed with compelling insights and supporting data. The challenger's response when confronted with this pushback, however, is to take control of the debate. But taking control of the debate around ideas is critical, not just because it shows that the sales rep isn't going to be a pushover, but also because those ideas that the challenger brings to the table, in other words, the new problems or opportunities the rep has taught the customer to value, are directly connected to the solutions that the supplier can offer to the customer. If the rep isn't willing to convince the customer that the problem is urgent, then he won't be able to convince the customer it's worth solving. Misconception number 3. Reps will become too aggressive if we tell them to take control. People also confuse taking control, that is, the challenger's tendency to be assertive during the sale, with aggressiveness. But these are actually two very different things. This is the last, but arguably most critical, misconception to address. If you think about sales rep behavior along a spectrum, we can array it with passive behavior on the one end and aggressive behavior on the other. Passive behavior, of course, is pretty self-explanatory. The rep gives in to the demands of others. They use accommodating language. They allow their personal boundaries to be breached by the customer. Sound familiar? These are the hallmarks of the relationship builder. The passive rep's primary goal is to please the customer. That desire is so powerful that relationship builders will do things that are not in their best interest or in their company's best interest. For example, proactively offering a discount when the customer hasn't even asked for one. There's little confusion among sales leaders about what passive behavior is. The real confusion is between assertive and aggressive. The primary difference between the two is one of posture. While aggressive people will pursue their goals by attacking others and using antagonistic language, assertive individuals are much more constructive, using strong language perhaps, but not so strong that it's off-putting or offensive. So the rep pushes the customer, but does so with respect and sensitivity to how the customer is reacting. The rep doesn't blindly pursue his own agenda, but instead moves purposefully, always sensing and responding. Take the example one of our members shared with us. One of his company's sales reps was selling paint to a large production line in early 2009. His company had poor margins due to the competitive environment exacerbated by rapid escalations in raw material costs. The rep for the paint supplier sent a price increase letter to purchasing and followed up with a visit to discuss the justification and to gain agreement for a price move at the beginning of the next quarter. The purchasing manager, however, flatly refused to take a price increase on the basis that business was bad, which it was. But the challenger rep did not roll over on his price. He stood his ground during the initial visit and two others, citing the dramatically improved productivity at the paint plant due to the supplier's installed equipment and dedicated staff. Despite threats from purchasing of dire consequences for the increase, the rep didn't cave. The rep made an appointment with the plant managers of the facilities affected by the increase, which were also the main consumers of the paint and the beneficiaries of the service. He laid out the issue and the need for the increase. He then reviewed all of the projects that the company had completed to improve productivity at their sites. The plant manager called in his leadership team to confirm what the sales rep was telling him. They supported his value claims. The rep then asked the plant managers to set up a joint meeting with the rep and purchasing to gain support for the increase. He did so, and the increase was ultimately accepted. In this case, the rep stood his ground and was extraordinarily assertive, but not aggressive. While he was certainly close to the edge with purchasing, he made his value case and stuck with it. Now, what's interesting about this continuum is how concerned sales leaders are that their sales reps are going to drift too far to the aggressive end of the spectrum. The general fear is that if you tell your reps to take control by being more assertive, they're going to jump over the middle of the continuum and move straight to aggressive. But in reality, we find that that almost never happens. More often than not, reps will continue to gravitate to the passive end of the continuum rather than move towards the aggressive end at all. They get stuck seeking to resolve tension with the customer rather than maintain it. Why does this happen? First, there's a perceived power imbalance in the rep-customer relationship. Reps think that the customer has significantly more power in the relationship. Therefore, they give in to customer demands for better terms and conditions because they feel they have no choice. They often back down before they even understand fully why the customer is making the request. For the average rep, it's either acquiesce quickly or lose the deal. But as real as that perception may be, it turns out that the reality is totally different. A recent survey by Bay Group International of sales reps and procurement officers determined that 75% of reps believe that procurement has more power, while 75% of procurement officers believe that reps have more power. At the very least, this data tells us that if reps are giving in because they believe the customer has more power, well, they're just plain wrong. Again, this is something that challenger reps seem to instinctively know. They don't back down in the sale because they know there's always more room to negotiate than a core performer would ever believe. The challenger just knows how to finesse or tailor it in the right way. We find that many sales professionals undervalue their contribution to the customer. They marginalize the tremendous value of their company's resources, not just technical expertise, but implementation and change management know-how, and overestimate the value of every single objection raised by the customer. This is often an aha moment for sales reps when we deliver our challenger training. We tell reps to think about the resources they have at their disposal to help their customers get better. To quote one of our SEC Solutions facilitators, think about it. You are teaching your customers things that they didn't know before. You have practical experience from hundreds, if not thousands, of implementations, while this may be the first such implementation for your customer. Taking control means that you know the value of the resources and you don't bring them to bear willy-nilly on a customer who isn't serious about the decision. If the customer asks for a case study or to talk to a reference, the relationship builder says yes. A challenger says sure, but let me ask you if this is the very last confirmation you need before we agree to work together and you sign the paperwork. Why? Because the challenger is confident in the value that he and his company will bring to the customer. Another reason most reps naturally gravitate to a more passive posture is a perceived erosion of control in the supplier-customer relationship, generally speaking. This is more of a temporal phenomenon brought on by challenging economic conditions. In a tough economy, a rep is happy to take any business. The last thing they're going to do when a deal is on the table is to push back on pricing. The rep just wants to get the thing closed before the customer changes their mind altogether. In difficult economic times, normally assertive reps behave more passively. And reps who are normally passive to begin with, well, they cave altogether. It's a buyer's market in large part because reps make it so by creating favorable negotiating conditions that tip the scales well in the customer's favor. A second reason that we see reps becoming more passive with customers, and this one hits close to home, is that you've told them to act this way. How so? As it turns out, management strategies exacerbate the tendency for most reps to go passive. If managers tell reps to focus on serving customers and advocating for their needs, to sit on the customer's side of the table, this message is often interpreted by salespeople as, give the customer whatever they want. We're hearing now more than ever before that sales leaders are urging their sales organizations to place the customer first. The term customer centricity is back in dramatic fashion. The assumption is that if companies want to grow coming out of the recent downturn, they're going to have to ensure that everything they do delivers maximum customer value. The problem, however, is that while most companies have been emphatic about their customer centricity, they've been equally vague with their sales organizations about how to actually do that. There are several ways to be customer-centric that are actually bad for business. Two examples that we hear about frequently from our members are discounts, or other terms and conditions that undermine profitability in exchange for little long-term gain, and assuming an order-taking posture with the customer. In other words, taking short-term orders when the customer is pushing for them instead of getting the customer to think about longer-term business. These are things that drive companies crazy, but the messages they send out to their sales force do little to dissuade reps from the notion that these are good things to be doing for customers. These drivers of overly passive rep behavior are the things that sales leaders need to overcome if they want to build challenger reps capable of taking control of the sale. The real question isn't how to get reps to stop from being too assertive, but rather how to get them to be assertive enough. Equipping reps to take control. How do companies shake reps out of their passive posture? Getting this right requires that they tackle the main obstacle that gets in the way of the average rep being able to effectively take control, a strong desire for closure. Reps naturally seek closure. Like most people, they're fundamentally uncomfortable with ambiguity, particularly because it's that ambiguity that typically stands between them and their commission checks. There's a natural human tendency, one that reps have to overcome, to want closure in uncomfortable situations. Succumbing to this tendency is one that absolutely kills the average rep. Challengers, by comparison, thrive in ambiguity. They know how to navigate it and understand how it can be leveraged to their advantage. They display a remarkable level of comfort with silence during the customer conversation, as well as with keeping negotiating points and customer objections open and on the table longer than one normally would. It might be a bit of an overstatement to say they like tension, but it probably isn't that far from the truth. Admittedly, this is a tough barrier to overcome. It isn't realistic to expect reps who do not like tension or ambiguity to suddenly start liking these things. At some level, this sort of response is hardwired in most of us. Either we're comfortable with these things or we aren't. And if we aren't, we'll look for any excuse to avoid them. But while you can't realistically change human behavior, you can help make reps aware of their natural tendencies and give them some practical tools for making sure that they don't prematurely cave when it comes to intense value discussions. This is where the DuPont practice comes in. They've developed some really smart negotiation training and tools for helping reps to avoid premature closure. Taking control case study, DuPont's controlled negotiation roadmap. As we go through the DuPont case, bear in mind that this practice focuses exclusively on taking control in negotiation settings. While challengers take control throughout the sale, the negotiating table is still a great place to study this notion. And DuPont offers a terrific example of how to equip reps to push customers in an assertive, but not an aggressive manner. Taking control is all about creating constructive tension, about challenging the way the customer sees the world and pushing back constructively in tough negotiations. At DuPont, they've employed some powerful tools to help reps overcome their natural inclination to give in to customer demands too early in the sale. DuPont worked with negotiation training vendor Bay Group International, though it is worth noting that several vendors offer robust negotiation training products that SEC members have been happy with. The goal in DuPont's case is very straightforward. This is about taking control, the third key ingredient to building challenger reps, and an area where we can have huge impact if we follow a recipe just like this. Purposeful planning. DuPont is the provider of a wide range of innovative products and services sold across many industries, including agriculture, electronics, transportation, construction, and safety and protection. The key to DuPont's approach to equipping reps to take control at the negotiating table is this. You've got to have a plan. The only way that reps are going to have the confidence to not back down from challenging the customer is if they've built a strategy for doing that in advance of the sales call itself. DuPont provides reps with a simple template for pre-negotiation planning based on Bay Group International's Situational Sales Negotiation Methodology, or SSN for short. The SSN template itself is brief, but the range and value of information that's collected is what's critical here, as all of this information together provides a powerful perspective and puts the rep in a significantly better position when it comes time to negotiate. This tool is all about ensuring that reps have the skills and tools to negotiate effectively rather than give in when the customer asks for concessions. The SSN template asks reps to note the relative power positions of the supplier, everything from products to brand, pricing, service, and relationships. The idea here is to get down on paper all of the areas in which we have relative strengths with the customer and all of the areas in which we have relative weaknesses. Done well, the detail in this template alone will provide the rep with a better sense of the larger value her company brings to the table and will build the rep's confidence to demand a greater price for that value. The SSN template also forces DuPont reps to think in advance about all of the information they need to get from the customer and to list the specific questions they're going to need to ask to find those things out. Likewise, it asks the rep to detail the information that the customer is likely going to want to know so that the rep is ready in the meeting to provide it or protect it, as the case may be. Next, what difficult questions and objections is the rep likely to get from the customer and how exactly does the rep plan to respond? It's always better to prepare answers in advance rather than be forced to come up with a response on the fly because that almost inevitably leads to giving in way too early to customer demands. This is followed by an examination of the specific things the supplier is looking for in the deal. things they can negotiate on, and a series of hypotheses around the customer's needs as well. Finally, the SSN template asks reps to do an analysis of possible concessions to offer the customer and concessions to request from the customer. For example, the customer might ask the rep to give in on price, and the rep might ask the customer to give in on some of their customization demands. The template asks the rep to score the value of those concession items for both the supplier and the customer. For example, the rep might determine that offering the customer a price concession reflects a 5 in terms of cost to the supplier, perhaps because they run on very thin margins, but only a 2 to the customer in terms of value, since they're primarily concerned not with price, but with the quality and workability of the product. As you consider this planning method, ask yourself how many of your reps take the time to map out this kind of information prior to the negotiation, particularly one when price is likely to come up as a sticking point. Remember, winning those conversations is what really sets challengers apart. The challenger rep has a scorecard like this wired into her brain. This is how she sees the world, and it's what allows her to push back on the customer when the time comes. Put another way, the SSN template is a proxy for what challenger reps do naturally. This is how you capture the magic of challenger rep pre-call planning and put it on one sheet of paper. Asking your reps to use a tool like this puts you one step closer to giving them the confidence to hang tough when the conversation turns more difficult. It also forces them to play out the next few interactions in the negotiation. Sales Executive Council research shows that one of the biggest differentiators of high-performing reps is the amount of time they spend planning. And this is a prime example. Like a great chess player, high performers are focused not just on the current move, but on the scenarios that will play out several moves ahead. DuPont found that for most reps, being assertive takes practice and planning. This is how you put structure around both. If you were to give a tool like this to 10 of your reps next week, right before they called on a customer, would they be able to fill it out? If the answer is troubling, chances are extremely good that your reps are giving in to customer demands too early because they're not equipped to push back in the moment. They're not equipped to challenge. What else can you do to equip reps to challenge the customer's demands once they're in the sales call itself and the customer starts placing demands on the deal? Anatomy of a successful negotiation. Navigating tough customer conversations is one of those things that always seems a little bit like magic. Some people just seem to be able to do it incredibly well, but it's never completely clear how. But what tangible steps can you take to help reps take control in the conversation itself? DuPont has demystified the process by boiling it down to a 4-step framework based on Bay Group International's methodology and then using the framework to put reps through a 2-day situational sales negotiation workshop focused on breaking sales reps' tendency to give in too soon. The framework has 4 parts. First, acknowledge and defer. Second, deepen and broaden. Third, explore and compare. And fourth, concede according to plan. Think of this as a roadmap for maintaining constructive tension within a negotiation. This is the kind of stuff your challengers do naturally in the place where everyone else needs exactly this kind of concrete guidance. How does it all work? Let's start with acknowledge and defer. How do you defer a customer demand for a concession, say a price discount, without threatening the deal? Here, DuPont has done something very smart and very straightforward. They've given reps the actual words to say when that moment comes. While it doesn't have to be verbatim, reps are encouraged to say something like, I understand that price is something we need to address, but before we do, I'd like to take a moment to make sure I completely understand your needs so we can make sure we're doing everything we can to make this deal as valuable as possible for you. Is that all right? It's a relatively simple request, but there's a lot going on here. The rep has promised closure, which the customer wants just as much as the rep, but has also won permission to proceed, assuming she gets it. And that's important because you have to win the customer's permission to defer. If you don't, they're not going to listen to anything you say next. This is a key mistake non-challenger reps make all the time. They rarely seek to defer at all. And if they do, it's without the customer's consent, which means they risk coming across as dismissive or, worse, aggressive. Once she has permission to continue, the rep is on to the next 2 steps, deepen and broaden, and then explore and compare, which we'll examine in parallel. At this point, the rep has bought some time, but has also created some tension in the conversation. So now the rep needs a way to manage that tension to have confidence to push forward. DuPont trains reps on a specific technique to get the deal to a better place when a customer pushes back on price. As we go through it, you'll see what makes it so powerful is that it's a straightforward, repeatable technique that can be copied and learned by non-challenger reps. For deepen and broaden, DuPont provides reps with tactics for uncovering the customer's underlying needs. And for Explore and Compare, reps are trained on tactics for comparing and evaluating the additional needs identified during the conversation. The primary idea here is to expand the customer's view of the things that are important to them. What else besides price matters? Maybe it's the warranty, or the service plan, or the expedited shipping, or even installation. Get it all out on the table so that price is no longer the only negotiable in play. During the deepen and broaden phase, the DuPont sales rep often starts with getting the customers to simply restate things the rep already knows the customer likes about the DuPont offering. Once the rep has broadened the universe as much as possible, she can start to shrink it back down, coming back to price, but in a very specific manner. In this technique, reps don't run directly to, I can give you 10%, not 20%. Instead, the conversation starts with, what are you looking to achieve with a 20% price reduction? The idea is to uncover the rationale for the request, as the appropriate response will depend on that rationale. Often the reason for the request is something that can be addressed in some other way, as it's often driven less by economic need and more by the customer's desire to achieve a specific business outcome, such as a production cost reduction. So look at what you're negotiating over now. It's not just price, but all of the other ways in which the supplier creates value for the customer and helps to solve their key challenges. Doing this, the rep has significantly expanded the options for negotiation. The rep's now in a much better place to offer concessions that are less painful to their top-line revenue and potentially options that the customer values more. As they move to comparing various trade-offs with the customer, this is where all the prep work they did with the pre-call planning tool becomes so incredibly important. If they've done their homework well, they know the cost-to-value trade-off for each one of the solution elements for their company. This brings us to the final mile of negotiation. Concede according to plan. This isn't just a fun play on words. Reps are taught the importance of proceeding according to a carefully planned negotiation strategy that trades away low-value solution elements first before defaulting to price. In other words, determining what you're willing to concede is important, but what is often overlooked is how and when in the negotiation those concessions should be given. There are many different ways to make concessions to a customer. Each can send a very different message to the customer, even when you ultimately achieve the exact same results. DuPont teaches their reps to avoid certain concession patterns, such as starting with small concessions and then offering bigger ones as the negotiations progress, or putting a take-it-or-leave-it offer on the table. Because these approaches are not just risky, they can leave the customer feeling cheated. Instead, they teach reps to concede negotiables in an order and in an amount that ensures both parties feel they're winning. For instance, they teach reps to start with a meaningful concession and then to offer smaller and smaller concessions as negotiations continue. Techniques like this help DuPont reps manage tension in a constructive manner. That's not something that non-challenger reps would have known how to do otherwise. The point here is to give them the information that they need to make better choices when it comes to negotiation and to understand the implications and possible repercussions of employing one of these strategies versus another. This is how you set them up for success when they challenge. To really get the feel for the difference, during the situational sales negotiation skill-building workshops, DuPont reps role-play different concession patterns and then discuss how they feel when the negotiation ends. This serves to illustrate the effect that different concession patterns will have on customers and ultimately gives reps the confidence that they have a smart plan to getting to an agreement, one that will leave the customer feeling that they won rather than they got cheated. A word of caution. While the DuPont case focuses on taking control within the negotiation phase of the sale, an earlier point in this chapter bears repeating here. Taking control happens throughout the sales process, not just the end of it. In our Challenger Development Program, much of the taking control module is not focused on negotiation at all. It's a point we really hammer home. Taking control has to happen throughout the sale, lest it end up feeling fake or worse, disingenuous or off-putting to the customer. We share several practical examples and techniques for doing this. One of the basic techniques we focus on is making powerful requests, which is something that should be done throughout the sale. Making powerful requests helps the customer understand that the rep is here to move things forward. It is a great tool from the challenger's taking control toolkit. How does it work? Here's a quick example. A rep has shown the customer that they're wasting millions on facilities costs because of their inefficient server management. The proposed solution will save the customer a good deal of money, but others need to be involved in the purchase decision if it's to move forward. A powerful request might sound something like this. From our discussion, we've agreed that the implementation of a rack-based server solution would save you $5 million a year. For you to reap these savings in the current fiscal year, we really need to start installing the new hardware soon. So to get started, I'll need a signed contract from Dave by the end of the week, which will allow us to bring the implementation engineers on site and start the process so you can hit your savings target. This is just one example, which is focused on closing, but there are many others that help reps understand how to take control even earlier in the sales process. Pulling it all together. Taking control is the one pillar of the challenger selling model that strikes most sales leaders as more nature than nurture. But while it's true that it helps for reps to have been born with the assertiveness gene, it is by no means a requirement for them to be successful. The solution to overcoming passivity is straightforward. Teach reps the importance of clarity of direction over quick closure, and teach them how to create real value within the sales process. When combined, these skills can help any sales rep to create a powerful proxy for natural assertiveness.
Chapter 8, The Manager and the Challenger Selling Model. So far, we've focused on the rep skills and organizational capabilities required to implement the challenger selling model. But anybody who's ever attempted to execute large-scale change within a sales organization will know there's one glaring omission to this story, the frontline sales manager. As a research organization devoted to improving sales performance, we've studied nearly every topic in the sales world, and the message and the data is always the same. If you don't get frontline sales managers on board, the initiative will fail. Whether it's change to comp plans, the CRM system, the sales process, or more basic skills and behaviors, it always comes back to the manager. The frontline sales manager in any sales organization is the fundamental link between strategy and execution. This is where change initiatives and Salesforce transformations live or die. Implementing the challenger selling model is no different. You cannot expect to successfully build a challenger sales organization if your frontline sales management layer is broken. It's the linchpin in terms of making the model work. While this point may be obvious to the seasoned sales leader, what sales organizations can actually do to boost manager effectiveness is less so. While there is rather broad consensus that manager quality is the most important lever for driving rep performance, sales leaders tend to view manager effectiveness as a sort of enigma. As one of our members told us, "I know that manager success is crucial to my overall success. Problem is, I don't know what to do about it." And that concern is widespread, especially as sales leaders look to the future. In fact, when we asked SEC members about manager capability, a shocking 63% reported that their managers do not have the skills and competencies they need as their sales model evolves, to say nothing of the 9% of managers who don't even have the skills required to be successful in their role currently. 3/4 of our members self-identify as having managers who aren't going to perform in the new environment. And that's deeply troubling. While leaders agree on the fundamental importance of the role, very few feel confident about the actual people currently occupying that role. And most are even less confident still about what to do about it. Portrait of a world-class sales manager. In an effort to identify the key attributes of a world-class sales manager, the skills, behaviors, and attitudes that matter most for sales management excellence, we created a survey we call the Sales Leadership Diagnostic. At last count, more than 65 companies had administered this diagnostic to more than 12,000 sales reps, and we've collected data on more than 2,500 individual frontline sales managers. As with any survey we conduct, the data is a strong representative sample of every major industry, geography, and go-to-market model across the council's membership. In the survey, we asked reps to assess their manager's performance across 64 different attributes of performance, spanning 4 broad categories. First, we asked about management fundamentals, things like integrity, reliability, recognition, and team-building skills. These variables aren't necessarily specific to sales, but they are incredibly important. So we included them in our analysis to understand how they compare to other attributes in terms of driving manager performance. Second, we looked at attributes related to actual selling ability. While we don't want our managers selling for their reps, it stands to reason that they probably do need to know how to sell if they're going to help others to do it better. Here, we asked about attributes like negotiation skills and whether the manager offers the customer unique perspectives. Third, we asked about the manager's coaching skills. Do managers prepare for and customize coaching interactions? Do they follow through on their development commitments? Lastly, we looked at sales-specific aspects of leadership, things like account planning, territory management, and the level of innovation the manager shows in positioning offers to customers. Next, to ensure that we weren't allowing one unhappy rep to skew our results, we excluded those managers from the analysis for whom we had data from fewer than 3 reps. Then, to make the results manageable, we applied factor analysis to the data, boiling it down to the smallest possible number of statistically significant groups or categories. The factor analysis told us that those 64 variables fall into 5 distinct categories. Finally, to understand how important each category is relative to the other 4, we ran a regression analysis of those factors against actual manager performance, as determined by both the reps and the companies. And that allowed us to determine, of all the things a manager could be good at, which of these 64 skills and behaviors matter most for actual manager performance, as assessed by the reps who observe those behaviors every single day, as well as by the companies who have a broader sense of how those managers maintain and grow their territories over time. Ultimately, this exercise generated the answer to the key question of manager performance. That is, the smallest number of statistically significant and distinct categories that, when combined, explain frontline sales manager excellence. To interpret what we found, let's start by separating management fundamentals, like reliability, integrity, and listening skills, from the more sales-specific drivers of manager performance. As it turns out, management fundamentals account for roughly 1/4 of sales manager success. These are the foundational skills that are necessary for success in any management job, irrespective of function. Yet, interestingly, we also found that performance on these attributes does not fall along a spectrum, but tends to be binary. Either you're reliable or you're not. You have integrity or you don't. And that in turn tells us that these are inherent traits you should be looking for in the people you hire, not skills you want to be developing in your staff over time. Put another way, great reps don't necessarily make great managers. You can't just excel at sales to be a great sales manager. You've also got to excel at management as well. Yet that is exactly how most companies still source new frontline management talent. This approach to hiring is the root cause of many organizations' high manager failure rates. Not surprisingly, our analysis of manager performance indicates that a handful of managers, roughly 4% in our sample, fail on at least one of these management fundamentals. So one of the first recommendations we make to SEC member companies completing the sales leadership diagnostic is that they find new positions for managers who fall into this 4%, because we haven't even gotten to the sales-specific attributes of world-class managers, and these people have already failed to meet the manager bar. On the other hand, while a star rep track record is not a reliable indicator of management potential, an alternative lies in the data presented in this chapter. Armed with an understanding of the star manager profile, organizations can adapt their candidate assessment protocols to look for candidates who are likely to demonstrate behaviors known to drive successful commercial outcomes. And knowing that some of these attributes are difficult, if not impossible, to develop over time, notably management fundamentals like integrity and reliability, these are clearly places where it makes sense to screen up front. However, traditional interview-based assessment methods can be unreliable indicators of candidate potential and basic management ability. As a result, we find that progressive companies use a variety of experiential live-fire assessment methods that let them see a candidate do the job before giving him the job. For example, one large high-tech manufacturer uses a full-day simulation-based skills assessment to pre-certify external candidates' management capabilities before employment offers are extended. A construction materials supplier uses a similar approach for internal candidates. Its pre-promotion sales manager screening ensures that candidates possess and demonstrate the core combination of skills necessary to succeed as sales managers. The sales side of sales manager excellence. In the Army, there's an old saying that applies equally well to sales. No plan survives engagement with the enemy. No matter how carefully one plans for battle, running through every possible scenario of what might happen and what might go wrong, the reality on the field will inevitably be different. As a result, Army leaders have adopted a style of leadership known as commander's intent. Commander's intent is just that, a clear, concise statement of the specific goal a commander is looking to achieve, something like capture and hold that hill until reinforcements arrive. In this approach to leadership, Army leaders have stopped giving step-by-step instructions on how to actually go about capturing the hill because they've learned that once their troops get out in the field and engage in battle, they're going to have to quickly adapt to the situation on the ground in unanticipated ways. Not surprisingly, then, the field leaders who excel in the Army are the ones who are creative, innovative, and able to adapt to their circumstances. Typically, they're the ones who recognize possible courses of action that no one behind the front would have recognized in advance, and then guide their troops to victory through creative interpretation of their commander's intent. It's proven to be a powerful management philosophy that matches process on the one hand with empowerment and innovation on the other. When victory is on the line, put the battle in the hands of your best field-based leaders, the ones who identify a wide range of choices and develop an innovative option that specifically matches to that particular situation. As it turns out, when we studied the sales side of management excellence, the attributes that account for the remaining 3/4 of a sales manager's success, we found the same thing to be true. And here is where our story shifts from preventing failure to promoting success. When we ran the analysis, we found that the attributes contributing to manager excellence fall into 3 high-level categories, and they're about what you might expect: selling, coaching, and owning. This last category is about the various aspects of business ownership that senior leaders like to see in their managers, the extent to which they run their territory as if it were their own business. So when we look at the statistically significant factors that define the sales side of sales manager excellence, the first thing we can say about this side of the manager job is that selling still matters. To be sure, these results aren't saying that your best managers spend 25% of their time selling, but they do indicate that if we were to explain what makes your best manager so much better than everyone else, roughly 25% of the reason would be because of their great selling skills. As all sales leaders know, selling skills are necessary at times, since managers are often asked to cover vacant sales territories, to help close the largest sales, or just to fill in for a rep who may be on leave. But more to the point, managers are also expected to be able to model great selling behaviors for their teams. What's especially interesting about the selling part of the story, however, is the specific attributes that rose to the top inside that category. Here we find that the same skills that matter most for manager success are the exact same sales skills we found to matter most for rep success. Offers the customer unique perspectives. Tailors the offer to the needs of customers. Is comfortable discussing money. This implies that your best managers are likely going to come from your challenger ranks, and it helps explain why top-performing managers are heavily sought after for the support they can provide on the largest, most complex deals, deals where challenger skills, as we have seen, are most needed. This brings us to the second sales-specific driver of manager effectiveness, which is coaching, accounting for 28% of frontline sales manager effectiveness. The size of this impact tells you what you probably'd expect. Coaching absolutely matters when it comes to sales management. It is a key element of manager effectiveness, and as we have long advocated to our members, a huge driver of rep performance as well. Unlike selling, however, which is about a manager's ability to be a rep when needed, coaching is about the manager working side by side with reps to share his knowledge, insight, and experience to diagnose and correct specific behaviors known to hinder high performance. When we look at the specific attributes of effective coaching, we find that the focus of these coaching efforts, at least for world-class managers, is again the same challenger skills we saw in the selling category, guiding reps to tailor effectively, showing reps how and when to assert control, helping reps through complex negotiations. Coaching is such an important part of the manager effectiveness story that we'll spend a good portion of this chapter discussing it. That said, it's not the whole story. While many sales leaders have come to simply equate good management with good coaching, it turns out that manager excellence is a matter of providing not just coaching, but leadership, direction, and guidance more generally. It's about demonstrating effective ownership of the business. Indeed, our analysis shows that more than 45% of sales manager excellence is a function of excelling at managing the overall business. While great sales managers are fantastic at coaching their reps, they're even better at building their business. Great coaching is important, but it's still only part of the story. Yet, if we were to have guessed, we would have said that being an effective sales leader is mostly about how one allocates resources. Things like driving process compliance, correcting actions out of step with that process, and managing resources across the territory as efficiently as possible. But it turns out that's not the case. All of these skills are captured in a category called resource allocation, which at just over 16% is the smallest of the four categories contributing to the sales side of sales manager excellence. And what that tells us is that resource allocation isn't the most important part of a sales manager's job. In fact, it's the least important part of the manager's job. So if sales leadership isn't about resource allocation, what is it about? Well, it turns out that sales leadership is mostly about how innovative sales managers are. Now, innovation is admittedly a loaded term that can mean many things to many people. What we're referring to here is managers collaborating with reps to understand as deeply as possible what's holding up a deal, figuring out why and where a deal is running into trouble at the customer, and then finding innovative ways to move it forward. It's important that innovation in this context is emphatically not about creating a new value proposition or inventing a new set of capabilities or product features. This is about creatively connecting the supplier's existing capabilities to each customer's unique environment and then presenting those capabilities to the customer through the specific lens of whatever customer obstacle is keeping that deal from closing. This is Commander's intent applied to the world of sales. It is about creatively modifying deal-level sales strategy to adapt to the specific customer context, the reality on the ground, as it were. What the sales innovation factor tells us is that star-performing managers have an uncanny ability to unstick stuck deals and get them closed. Notice how different this is from coaching. Coaching is about driving performance around known behaviors. It's a perfect approach to sales management in a world characterized by a predictable path to success. Innovation, on the other hand, is about driving performance through unforeseen obstacles. It's best suited to a world of dynamic and unexpected events. In coaching, the manager already knows the answer and imparts it to the rep. In innovation, neither the rep nor the manager knows the answer, so instead, they collaborate through the manager's leadership to discover an effective path forward. You can't coach what you don't know, but you can innovate. Arguably, the biggest finding from all of our work on sales managers is just how important this innovation skill really is. At 29%, sales innovation is the single biggest sales-related attribute contributing to world-class sales manager performance. More important than selling skills, and much more important than a manager's ability to allocate resources. While coaching is a close second at 28%, what's so interesting about sales innovation is that unlike sales coaching, which has received a huge amount of time and attention over the last 5 years, it isn't something that most sales leaders have really ever thought about in any systematic fashion before. If given a blank sheet of paper and asked to list the 4 to 5 attributes that account for manager success, how many of us unprompted would have included anything other than selling, coaching, and resource allocation on that list? And yet the data tell us that sales innovation is a distinctly important set of attributes. In their survey responses, reps often ranked a manager high on coaching attributes, but low on sales innovation attributes, or vice versa. The two skills moved independently of one another. Sales innovation is the missing link in terms of fully realizing the benefits of the challenger selling model. Even armed with the best teaching pitches and honed capabilities for tailoring and taking control, even with strong sales managers who can coach these behaviors and can model the challenger selling behaviors themselves, many deals will still not happen. While the challenger model increases the likelihood that deals will move through the funnel, beating the status quo is a hard task. Customers are reluctant to change. The requirements for consensus continue to expand. decision makers will continue to choose no decision even over a good decision. This is where the innovative manager comes in. Armed with the ability to innovate at the deal level, the manager can help the rep avoid no decision land more often than the rep, even a challenger rep, can on her own. It's a critical capability in the battle to sell increasingly complex solutions to understandably ever more reluctant customers. For most sales leaders on a mission to improve the effectiveness of their frontline sales managers, these data reveal a huge untapped opportunity to dramatically improve sales manager performance. Because of that, we're going to spend some time in this chapter digging into this concept of sales innovation to really understand what it is, how it works, and most important, how we can build it more systematically into our entire sales manager population. Before we get into this notion of sales innovation in more detail, however, it first makes sense to engage in a deeper discussion around sales coaching. Formalized sales coaching represents one of the biggest opportunities to improve rep performance in a complex sales environment, but it is also one of the most misunderstood and mismanaged productivity levers. Coaching to the known. To understand why coaching is often mismanaged by sales organizations, we need to start with a definition of coaching. This is the definition of coaching that we've established with the help of a working team of members. An ongoing and dynamic series of job-embedded interactions between a sales manager and a direct report designed to diagnose, correct, and reinforce behaviors specific to that individual. This definition lays out the foundation of coaching and also how it differs from training. There are a few points we always emphasize with our members in terms of this definition. First, coaching is ongoing. It's continuous as opposed to a one-off event or series of training events. Second, it involves diagnosis specific to the individual rep. So coaching is customized. Whereas training typically involves a one-size-fits-all approach of delivering the same teaching in the same format to everyone, coaching is completely tailored to an individual rep's specific needs. And finally, coaching is behavioral. It's not just about obtaining skill and knowledge. It's about demonstrated application of that skill and knowledge. None of this is to suggest that training has no value. Training is good for sharing knowledge. Coaching is about acting upon it. The unique advantages of coaching stem from how it's tailored to the individual and systematically delivered at the point of need. Many organizations define coaching simply as informal training, but our research has shown that effective coaching is, in fact, very formal. It's highly structured and regularly scheduled. In the conversations we have with our members on this topic, there's another important distinction we make, which is how coaching differs from managing. While most frontline managers we speak with maintain that they do coach, for many, those efforts amount to little more than managing. We tell rather than ask. We do rather than guide. The business case for coaching. One coaching finding the council is best known for shows the huge impact that effective coaching can have on a sales organization. When you improve coaching quality, the performance curve doesn't shift, it tips. The middle moves, but the feet don't. What exactly does that imply? First, moving from below average to above average coaching appears to have little impact on our weakest performers, which seems counterintuitive. You'd imagine that these reps would be the easiest people to get a performance pop from if you could just coach them a little bit better. But the data tell us just the opposite. You can't coach away a bad fit for a job. Likewise, the shift from weak to strong coaching doesn't have much of an impact on star performers either. This finding is also a bit counterintuitive, since you'd like to think that coaching could make stars even more stellar. The analogy we use is a professional golfer. Many of them have swing coaches that they work with all the time, but in the end, they're hoping to shave maybe a stroke off their average. They're already high performers. They're only looking for slight incremental improvements beyond their current level of play. But if you're a core performer, the quality of the coaching you receive has a significant impact on your performance. The data from our research suggests that the median performers on your sales force could see a performance boost of as much as 19% given a significant improvement in the coaching they receive. The impact of simply moving from the bottom third to the top third of coaching effectiveness would still result in a performance gain of between 6 and 8% for the core of the sales force. Not many investments can deliver that sort of productivity lift to a sales organization. This isn't just theoretical impact, it's real. We've seen this from the majority of the organizations we work with that have embarked on this coaching journey. One of our members, a major player in the insurance industry, saw a result similar to what our data suggests. A 10% improvement in rep performance for those reps who participated in the company's new coaching program versus those who didn't. Coaching matters. Formalized coaching represents a huge performance improvement opportunity in a complex sales environment. It can make the difference between hitting or missing goal for the bulk of your sales force. Our strong recommendation to our members looking to improve sales performance is to do away with coaching democratically, that is to say, coaching everyone equally, and instead shift the majority of their coaching focus away from low and star performers and towards the core. What's more, it turns out that coaching isn't just a huge driver of sales performance. It's also a major factor in employee retention and what we call discretionary or extra effort. This was one of the bombshell findings from our original quantitative study on this topic, as it showed just how much impact coaching quality can have on employee morale. What the data tells us is this: good coaches make people want to stay. Bad coaches, on the other hand, create a fundamentally demoralizing environment and drive people from the organization. This is true not just for our low performers, but also for our core and star performers. To corroborate this finding, we also cut the data by discretionary effort. We included a question in our survey that asked just how much effort people put into their working day in sales. Essentially, what we found is that bad coaching and bad managers make people want to give up. From low-performing reps to our superstars, none of them can be bothered if they don't feel they're getting effective coaching from their managers. Coaching quality absolutely matters. Give sales managers something to coach too. When it comes to delivering quality coaching, the key lesson we've learned from several years of researching this topic is that managers can't coach effectively unless they have something to coach to. You can't just say, go forth and coach. You have to make it concrete for your managers. They need to have something to coach to, a clear understanding of what good looks like in your organization when it comes to sales. In other words, they need a hypothesis. While we've documented a whole range of coaching best practices and tools and templates at the council, one of the smartest tactics we've seen employed for boosting sales coaching quality came to us from one of our members in the financial services industry. They built their new coaching process directly on top of their existing sales process, so that managers' coaching efforts are directly embedded into the sales activities they're already pursuing with their sales team. If you were to look at what this company built for their sales managers, what you'd find is that each sales process stage has a different set of objectives. These are the behaviors critical to that stage that the company wants to reinforce. The tool also offers a number of sample questions a manager might ask to engage his reps in a coaching conversation around the objectives of that particular stage. So, for example, in stage one, opportunity creation, the manager consults this chart to verify the specific objectives and activities associated with this stage in the sales process. Things like setting and confirming a clear objective for the sales call and completing sufficient pre-call research. Things your high performers are probably doing already. Then below that, you find the questions the manager can use to elicit how the rep is pursuing those objectives. For example, what is your primary objective for this call? We found that what often happens is that managers focus on outcomes rather than behaviors in coaching conversations, saying things like, your conversion rate is way down. What's the problem? Aren't you following the process? That's not really what you should be after. Some members like to call that spreadsheet coaching. It's focused on business results, not behaviors, and it's delivered in a one-size-fits-all manner. Everybody gets the exact same treatment. But done well, coaching is about behaviors, not outcomes. And that's exactly what makes this tool so effective. Even better, all of this is captured on a single-page roadmap. It's a very simple tool, all on a single sheet of paper. In fact, this company's sales managers carry laminated versions of this page with them everywhere they go. It's a perfect cheat sheet for jump-starting coaching conversations without requiring a bunch of procedural hoops and training and admin. In a world where most managers are, at best, skeptical about coaching, a tool like this goes a long way by giving managers a practical, non-intrusive framework for coaching that isn't over-engineered and that doesn't require them to dramatically change their behavior. On our website, thechallengersale.com, we've provided our manager coaching guide built specifically to help reinforce the challenger selling model. This is the same tool our solutions group uses in its challenger development program. Like the sales process aligned coaching guide we just reviewed, it maps to the pillars of the model, teaching, tailoring, and taking control, providing managers with guidance around what good looks like for each of these critical behaviors, as well as starter questions to facilitate coaching discussions. Help managers to pause for effective coaching. The importance of the manager, and specifically the manager's role as coach in making the challenger model stick, is almost impossible to overstate. Given the importance of good coaching to driving behavior change of this sort, we tell our members to start from the assumption that their coaching program is probably not working as well as it should be. In our SEC Solutions group, we've worked with dozens of companies to help their sales managers improve their coaching abilities, teach deal innovation skills, and otherwise raise the quality of the frontline manager core. One of the key components of our manager development program is hypothesis-based coaching, which we think addresses the most pervasive issue companies struggle with when it comes to coaching. Getting managers to execute the double jump from product selling rep to solution selling manager, becoming experts in observing sales interactions as well as experts in coaching based on those interactions. Hence, hypothesis-based coaching, where managers enter coaching conversations with a clear hypothesis of what good looks like. Hypothesis-based coaching leverages a powerful framework called PAUSE, and it's something we encourage all of our members to use with their managers. Here's what PAUSE stands for. Preparation for the coaching conversation. Managers need to do proper and thorough preparation in advance of any coaching session. This provides continuity between coaching events, and by thinking through which stage of the sales process the rep is in, managers can tell what behaviors are going to be critical, which is a first step to solving the observation problem of situational variation. Affirm the relationship. If the rep isn't ready to hear the coaching and buy into the manager's role as coach, the coaching effort will be wasted. Managers need to be taught how to emphasize development by separating performance management from coaching interactions. There is always a gray line, but it is possible to create safe situations for coaching to occur. Understand expected or observed behavior. The challenge for many managers is to understand what they're seeing and what to look for when observing their reps. If managers understand what should be happening in a meeting, it's much easier to know if it is happening. Specify behavior change. If managers know what defines critical behaviors and have an objective standard for judging those behaviors, it's very easy for them to provide specific objective feedback. This prevents coaching from being generic, subjective, ill-focused, or overwhelming. Embed new behaviors. The purpose here is to move a coaching program away from being all about the coaching moment and instead making it an institutionalized process. Companies should provide tools that allow managers to create action plans for each of their reps, give continuity to managers' coaching conversations, and give second-line sales managers a quantitative and qualitative view into their managers' coaching activities and abilities. Again, we like this framework because it surmounts some of the big obstacles to delivering coaching effectively. We also find that the notion of pause can be